Carl gave a talk, which seemed to last forever, and did in fact. Nobody could stop him. Went on and on and on. It was a very boring talk. Some of the spouses of the people at the conference were sitting in the lawn outside the building, and suddenly a window opened and someone jumped out. Not being able to stand the talk any longer, and we always refer to this as the defenestration at Marburg. Well, I don't want to precipitate a defenestration at Waterloo, but unfortunately I have decided to change my talk at the last minute and begin with these items that you see on the blackboard here, because I think that they will help the quantum computation and information people understand a little better what the quantum logic enterprise is all about. And since I'm going to do that, I probably won't be able to finish the talk that I had originally prepared without precipitating a defenestration, which I don't want to do. So I won't finish the talk that I originally prepared, but I think I may be able to cover enough of it so that you get the spirit of it, and it will appear in published form sometime down the line if anyone is really interested. All right. In around 1978, Charlie Randall and I, who were working together on quantum logic, discovered that the category of orthomodular posets did not admit a tensor product. And this was very discouraging, because if you don't have a tensor product, you cannot handle coupled systems, and the entire quantum logic project is defunct. And we looked carefully to see why the tensor product could not be formed, and we found that the reason was that the category was simply too small. We had to enlarge the category. And so we had to invent the notion of an orthoalgebra, which is what Alex spoke about earlier today. But it was a little bit embarrassing, because for years we had thought that orthomodular posets were the end-all and the be-all of quantum logic. And we decided that what we needed was a guiding paradigm so that we wouldn't paint ourselves into another corner. And the guiding paradigm we came up with is this four-way paradigm, which, with apologies to Murray Gell-Mann, we sometimes refer to as the fourfold way. There are four facets of the quantum logic enterprise, and they are the operational facet, the stochastic facet, property or attribute facet, and the subjective facet. And these four facets are connected in many ways, and it is the connections among them that are particularly intriguing. Now, if you mention the word test, or experiment, or observation, or observable, or procedure, you are probably down here at this level in the diagram, the operational level. You're talking about operations that you can perform on or in connection with a physical system which is under study and which is thought of perhaps as at least in some sense being isolated from the rest of the world, and we're going to focus our attention on that system. We want to talk about probabilities of various outcomes in connection with the execution of the operations at the operational level. And this raises us up to the stochastic level in the diagram. And Charlie and I like to think of the probabilities at the stochastic level as being perhaps frequency probabilities, long-run relative frequencies, or if you don't like that because you realize that in the long run we'll all be dead, simply as mathematical artifacts in the spirit of Kolmogorov that can be used as sort of coat hangers to hang data on. Over here at this level in the diagram, we want to talk about properties or attributes of the physical system under consideration. The object of all of this activity is to raise us up to the top level, the subjective level, the epistemological level, the level at which we formulate concepts, theories about the physical system under consideration. Now, if you look at the fourfold paradigm a little bit, you will realize that it is possible to classify many of the talks that we've heard so far from the quantum logic people in connection with this diagram. For instance, I think that it can be argued that the work of Sonia and Alexandru fits over into this area here in the four-way paradigm, because the propositions with which they dealt concern properties or attributes of the physical system in question. Albeit these properties were represented by sets of states, and if you interpret the states stochastically, you have this connection in here, but the main activities took place over here at this level. And recall that some of the properties were considered to be testable. Well, testable puts us down at the operational level here, where we can do experiments, measurements, that sort of thing. And so I think that the work that I have just alluded to took place at that level. Now, I think that Chris Fuchs' talk, I don't know if he would agree with me or not, but it seemed to me that he was advocating that we proceed directly from the operational level up to the epistemic level here by using the machinery of Bayes' probability. And of course, that's a very attractive idea. Just bypass this machinery here and go directly to the formulation of probabilities in the sense of betting rates, De Finetti betting rates, or in the sense of credibilities or degrees of belief pertaining to the physical system under consideration. On the other hand, if you wish to proceed from the stochastic level, where you're talking about states of the physical system, up here to degrees of belief or betting rates, that's where statistics comes into play. And the standard machinery of statistics, perhaps adapted to the quantum mechanical situation, would include things like Bayesian inference, like confidence intervals, like maximum likelihood, like hypothesis testing, that sort of thing. That's this connection in here. Now, the connection from attributes or properties of the physical system up to knowledge about the physical system by analogy with statistical inference on this side of the picture, you might think of as scientific inference, scientific induction, the formulation of physical theories. Whereas the statistical inference is more or less highly codified, the connection from here up to here, of course, is what requires scientific genius, which is why I am constrained to work down in this area here. And that leads us over to the talk, at least the partial talk that I will give today. The partial talk that I will give today, as I've indicated here, takes place down in this area and is based on what I would like to call the three-way paradigm. And it, up at the top of the three-way paradigm, we have a physical system. PS stands for physical system. I don't mean the actual ontological physical system out there in the real world. I mean a model, mathematical model for the physical system. And various models come to mind, some of them more inclusive than others. Now, BS down here does not stand for Barbara Streisand or anything else that you might think of right away. It stands for Boolean system. Boolean system. And by that, I do not necessarily mean a Boolean algebra, as will emerge from, I think, the part of the problem. This will emerge from the part of the talk that, with luck, I'll be able to get to. And the VS over on the other side, that stands for valuation structure, evaluation system. Typically, this, can you still hear me, or did I break the microphone? Okay. Evaluation system, this typically would be something like the real numbers or the unit interval, although it might be something that's not totally ordered. It might be a partially ordered system in which we can compare various aspects of the physical system. The connection between the Boolean structure and the physical system, I propose to try to explain, if I have time, is a generalized notion of an observable. The connection from the physical system to the evaluation system, particularly if the evaluation system is the real numbers, is the state. It's a state of the physical system. And if you combine an observable and a state, then you get what you might think of as an expectation mapping. And now there is one extremely important part of the three-way paradigm, which I will now put in, which is the notion of a symmetry. And this is where symmetry groups come into play. You might have a group of symmetries acting on the physical system. This is also where quantum gates, of course, come into play as unitary operators on the qubits and so forth. Notice that if you take the observable alpha and compose it with sigma, you get a new observable. And this is just the Heisenberg picture of symmetries acting on observables. On the other hand, if you first perform the physical symmetry, follow it by the state omega, then you have transformed the state into a new state. And that, of course, is the Schrodinger picture of state transitions induced by physical symmetries. And of course, the symmetries could be temporal symmetries, and that's where dynamics would come into play. Okay. That's what I wanted to say before I started the talk that I had originally prepared, and now let's see how far I can get with that. To begin with, the activity that I'm going to be talking about at first will take place up here at the level of a physical system, and there are various mathematical structures that are conventionally used to represent the system. In quantum mechanics, in orthodox quantum mechanics without super selection rules, the structures are the usual things, the bounded operators on the Hilbert space. Now, in there, in the bounded operators, live such things as the unitaries, representing the symmetries, the partial unitaries, which figure into the polar decomposition, and the Hermitian operators, or the self-adjoint operators, bounded self-adjoint operators. And, of course, the Hermitian operators are of particular importance because they represent the bounded observables. If you want unbounded observables, they're going to come into play in a moment anyway, in a different way. Now, in the passage from the bounded operators to the Hermitian operators, the bounded self-adjoint operators, we do lose something. The bounded operators form an algebra, a linear associative algebra. With an involution, the passage from an operator to its adjoint, and with all sorts of structure. It's a von Neumann factor. It's well understood, and it is a beautiful structure. When we drop down to the self-adjoint operators, we lose a lot of the multiplicative structure. Of course, the product of two self-adjoint operators is not usually self-adjoint. But we don't lose the additive structure. We can still add two self-adjoint operators. And in fact, under addition, the Hermitian operators form a group, which is why I've called it G, because I want to focus on Hermitian operators as an abelian group under addition. Now, we've lost something when we go from the bounded operators to the Hermitian operators, namely the unrestricted use of products. But we've gained something because the Hermitian operators form a partially ordered set in the standard way, one Hermitian operator being less than or equal to another Hermitian operator if for every expectation value induced by a state, the expectation of the first operator is less than or equal to the expectation of the second operator. So in the passage from this very nice ring or algebra down to the abelian group, we lose something and we gain something. Now, we don't completely lose the multiplicative structure when we drop down to G, courtesy of Jordan, because G forms a Jordan algebra. So there's a certain fragment of multiplication that survives as we drop down to G. Now, you've heard a thing or two during this conference about effect operators. The use of effect operators was pioneered by Gunther Ludwig, who organized that conference in Marburg, people like Polievo. It's developed from there into a very important part of what is now standard quantum mechanics, namely the use of POVM measures. What are the effect operators? Well, as I mentioned, G is partially ordered. It has acquired this partial order structure, and the effect operators are simply the operators lie between zero and the identity in the partial order. It's the unit interval, if you will, in the partial order in the Hermitian group G. And you are aware that the projection operators can be regarded, since the time of von Neumann, have been regarded as corresponding to propositions about the physical system under consideration, propositions that we now realize are sharp, because the spectrum of a projection consists at most of 0 and 1, no and yes, sharply, whereas the spectrum of an effect operator contains real numbers anywhere on the unit interval from 0 to 1. Sharp observables take on their values in P, in the projection geometry. Okay. And the projection geometry, you've heard talks about the fact that we now know courtesy of Piron, the work of Keller, and finally the work of Maria Pia Soler, we know how to characterize P abstractly, and even to characterize what the coefficients of the Hilbert space are, whether they're reals, complexes, or quaternions, in terms of the, well, you might say geometric structure of the projection geometry, if you will, of the Hilbert space. Well, that's the prototype. Now, I'm trained in mathematics, and only a little bit in physics, and not at all in quantum information. Being trained in mathematics, when you see something as attractive as P, E, G, and B, the first thing you want to do is understand it, and you do that by generalizing it, by throwing away part of the structure that you think is maybe not so essential, and trying to find the part of the structure that really makes things tick, that makes things work. And I've tried to do that a little bit anyway. So the generalization that we're going to be talking about then will be to four structures patterned on projections, effects, Hermitian operators, and bounded operators, which naturally I will refer to as P, E, G, and R. Now, P is going to be an orthomodular poset. Rather, it turned out to be an orthoalgebra, but in the end, because the orthomodular posets, as I explained, don't, in general, have good tensor products, although some of them do. But that's how it comes out. E will be a so-called effect algebra, and Howard has given some very nice talks on what an effect algebra, generalized effect algebra, is. G is going to be something new. It's going to be a compression-based group, whatever that is, and I probably won't get to that point in my talk, but it'll be patterned after the Hermitian group up above, and it will be a partially ordered abelian group, additively written, and so you can think of the elements in G as analogs of Hermitian operators, and I can add them and I can compare them. One might be less than or equal to another. And R will be the analog of B of H, although I don't necessarily want the full linear structure. I'm just going to look at it as a ring. So R is going to be a ring. I can multiply and I can add in R. And this will be my generalization. Now, it turns out that for some important examples, we can't necessarily manufacture the ring R. All right, then we have to deal only with P, E, and G, and it turns out that a lot can be done with P, E, and G alone. We don't always need the enveloping ring R. Simplest examples. The simplest example you could think of would be to go up to the prototype and look at the one-dimensional case. See, I guess you could look at the zero-dimensional case, but that's too trivial. The simplest example would be the one-dimensional case of the prototype. And all right, the bounded operators in one dimension are simply the complex numbers. The Hermitian operators are, of course, the real numbers. Now, keep in mind, though, that I want to consider this second thing, the analog Hermitian operators, only additively. So I'm only looking at the real numbers here as an additive, partially ordered structure. Yeah, you can multiply them, but for the time being, I'm not interested in that. If you drop down to the analog of the effects were Hermitian operators lying between 0 and 1, so I drop down to the real numbers lying between 0 and 1, and that's the standard unit interval. Aha, that's kind of nice. That's where states take on their values by the Born formula. You multiply a density matrix by a self-adjoint operator, take the trace, and you get a real number lying in the unit interval. If the self-adjoint operator itself lies in the unit interval, that is if it's an effect operator. So that's kind of nice, that shows up. What are the analogs of the projections? Well, the projections are idempotents. What are the idempotents in the complex numbers? Or there's only 0 and 1. 0 and 1. Ah, 0 and 1. But that's a nice structure. Yes, no, again. That's the primordial Boolean algebra. Yes, no. The Boolean, primordial Boolean algebra. And every Boolean algebra, remember, I said by Boolean structure, I don't necessarily mean Boolean algebra, but Boolean algebra is okay to go there. Every Boolean algebra can be manufactured from the 0-1 Boolean algebra, courtesy of Stone's, the weak form of Stone's representation theorem. It's a subdirect product of 0-1 Boolean algebra. You just put them together in a big product and then drop down to a subdirect product. Okay, fine. So that's a simple example to keep in mind. Now, if you want to look at the example, the simple example here, but look at it from a discrete point of view rather than a continuous point of view. Here is what you would get. If you want to discretize the complex numbers, you could, of course, look at Gaussian integers, but that's not quite the right thing to look at here. What you want to do, in hindsight, to discretize this thing is drop down in R and C to the ring of integers. Now, in this part of the picture here, the ring of integers is thought of as a ring. That's the analog of our ring of operators here. And in this part of the picture, Z is thought of simply as a partially ordered abelian group under addition. We forget that we can multiply the integers, but as sets, these two things are equal. Now, when we discretize and drop down, this way, looking in Z in the integers, partially ordered now, so we look at all the integers that lie between 0 and 1, the unit interval. Well, there are only two. And so we pick up our primordial Boolean algebra, 0, 1, here in two places. And so when we discretize this simple example here, we get an equality at this point and an equality at this point. And there's the picture. Okay. Now, if we want to generalize all this business, we could start with P and try to construct E, G, and R from P. Now, if your name is John von Neumann, you can do that, because you think of P as sort of a generalized projective geometry, and then out of thin air, and sitting around in your bathrobe before breakfast in the morning, you construct R, the coordinate ring of the generalized projective geometry. But for us mere mortals, and in particular for me, I have to start up at the top with the ring and then extract P, E, and G. So let's start up at the top. What kind of structure do we want to impose on the ring? Well, we're going to simply look at the prototype, the operators on the bounded operators on the Hilbert space, and we're going to formulate the notion of an effect-ordered ring. Effect-ordered ring. Now, what is an effect-ordered ring? Okay, think of R as bounded operators on the Hilbert space. Okay, and think of R plus as the positive Hermitian operators. Well, I don't really mean the zero. I'm regarding zero as a positive operator. If you want the technical term, it would be positive semi-definite, but I'm just going to call it positive. Right. So R plus is going to be the positive Hermitian operators. That's what you think of. And I'm calling this an effect-ordered ring because it turns out that it is sort of an ordered ring, and the order comes sort of from the effect operators, which are between, okay, that's just a name. It's not really a very good name, but it's a name. Here are the assumptions. I'm going to assume that R is a ring with unity 1, okay, the unit operator. It's what you keep in mind. One is in R plus. Yes, one is certainly a positive Hermitian operator. You can add two positive Hermitian operators. You get a positive Hermitian operator. R plus closed under addition. If you have a positive Hermitian operator and its negative is also a positive Hermitian operator, better be zero. That certainly is true. That's this postulate here. And for all elements R, S in R plus, think of positive semi-definite Hermitian operators. For all R, S in R plus, these four properties hold. The first property is that R, a positive semi-definite self-adjoint operator, can be written as a finite sum of effects. That's so trivial, I don't want to show you why it works. What's an effect here? An effect, it would be an element in R plus, such that 1 minus E is also in R plus, you see. So it's positive, and 1 minus it is positive, so it's less than or equal to 1, bigger than or equal to 1, it belongs to the unit interval. So this is why I call this an effect-ordered ring, because the order, which is determined by the positive cone, R plus, is determined by the effects. Okay, that's the first postulate. The other postulates are more familiar. If you take two self-adjoint positive definite operators, R and S, if they commute, their product is, again, positive semi-definite. That's that axiom. If I take any two positive semi-definite operators, R and S, look at RSR, that's, again, positive semi-definite. That's that axiom. And finally, if I look at the difference between two positive semi-definite operators, well, I get a Hermitian operator, not necessarily positive semi-definite anymore, but if I square it, I get a positive semi-definite operator again. That's that axiom, okay? And that these are the axioms for an effect-ordered ring stolen directly from properties of the ring of bounded operators on a Hilbert space. But it turns out this is all you need to do a lot of good business with. Okay. If I take two elements of my ring, A and B, I'm going to find A less than or equal to B if and only if B minus A is in R plus. Naturally, how else would you do it? Now, on the whole ring, that's not a very good order. It's not a very good partial order on the whole ring. If you think of doing it for the simple example where we take the complex numbers and then the positive Hermitian operators, those would be the non-negative real numbers, right? And take two complex numbers and say that A is less than or equal to B if B minus A falls on the positive real axis. Well, it's a partial order, all right, but it's kind of a skinny partial order, and it's not really very good for much of anything. But it is a partial order. However, if I restrict that partial order to the Hermitian operators, then I get something that's worthwhile. That's what I'm going to do. I'll define G of R, the analog of the Hermitian operators now, for my effect-ordered ring, to be all differences, all elements that are differences of positive semi-definite operators in the prototype. All elements that form A minus B, where A and B are in R plus. Now, it doesn't take much to check that every Hermitian operator is the difference of two positive semi-definite Hermitian operators. So this would give, this would jibe perfectly with the prototype. I'm going to define G of R plus to be R plus. Of course, R plus is contained in G of R, right? And then I'm going to partially order G of R by restriction of this partial order on the ring, which is not very good. But when I restrict it to G of R, I get something quite worthwhile. How about the effects? Well, the effects are going to be the elements between 0 and the unity in the ring. What else? And how about the projections? Well, idempotent elements of the ring. And now I have my candidate for P, E, G, and R. This will be our first generalization. And it turns out that a lot of what one wants to do in quantum mechanics can be done in this rather rarefied atmosphere, but it's a little easier to think about because we've thrown away a lot of structure that's really not needed. However, we can only do business to a certain point before we have to begin making assumptions about our Archimedean and so forth and so on. Okay. Anyway, it turns out that P of R is an orthomodular poset. It's a theorem. E of R is an effect algebra. This follows directly from the lecture that Howard gave the other day, because you're looking at the unit interval in a partially ordered abelian group. G of R is a compression-based group, but I probably won't get around to telling you about that. But it's a partially ordered abelian group. And R is an effect ordered ring. Now, let's see, how's my time going? If I'm right, I got 10 minutes. Is that right? Okay. Examples. The two examples that we saw before, complex numbers, define C plus to be non-negative reals. The integers, define Z plus to be, guess what, all the non-negative integers. That satisfies all the conditions. Here's a little more interesting example. Take your favorite C star algebra. Call it R. Look at it as a ring. Define R plus to be everything in the form AA conjugate, AA star. Being a mathematician, I write my conjugate with a star rather than a dagger, okay? AA star, A running through R. And then R is, in fact, an effect-ordered ring. G of R is nothing but the permission operators in the C star algebra, just what you want. They're partially ordered by R plus, which is contained in G of R. And the effects are what you want them to be, and the projections are the self-adjoint idempotents, the Hermitian idempotents. Here's another example. Take a compact Hausdorff space, find R to be the continuous functions, continuous complex valued functions on that space. We find G of R to be the real valued continuous functions, which is a subset of the bigger ring. Define R plus to be the real valued functions that are non-negative valued. You get an effect ordered ring. What do the projections come out to be? Well, they're the idempotents, self-adjoint idempotents, Hermitian idempotents. They come out to be the characteristic set functions of the compact open subsets of X. That's standard stuff. This is what you get when you take a commutative subalgebra of B of H use the Gelfand-Neimark representation theorem. That's what you get. So that's a special case. Here's another example. You take your favorite measurable space. You look at the ring of bounded measurable functions. This time I'll just look at the real valued functions. You let R plus again be the functions that are non-negative valued. What else? And then you look at the effects. And what are the effects? The effects are the fuzzy sets in the sense of zeta. So you get fuzzy set theory coming up here almost for free as a special case of this. What are the projections? The projections are, the characteristic functions, this time of sets of measurable sets. So P of R in this case, notice that in both of these cases, P of R comes out to be a Boolean algebra. Not just any old orthomodular poset, but a Boolean algebra. Now I guess I've got 6 minutes. All right. Well, I wanted to get to this anyway, and so I've got there. I want to talk about a Heilpern-Ritter ring. This is going to be another example of an effect-ordered ring. Let's say that R is a Heilprin-Ritter ring, HR ring, if R is a commutative lattice-ordered ring. So it's now it's a full-blown partially ordered ring. That is to say, the addition and the multiplication interact in the usual way with the partial order, translation, invariant, all that good stuff. But it's got to be lattice ordered so that any two elements of the ring have a supremum and an infimum, right? Least upper bound, greatest lower bound. It's got to have a unity, and it's going to satisfy two conditions. First condition, for those of you in the know, says that the unity element in this ring is a strong order unit. Any element in the ring, if I take the unity and add it to itself enough times, I'll go up above any element in the ring. That's a standard condition. The second condition, that's why Ritter's name is on here. The second condition, which is a condition discovered by Nate Ritter, who was my last PhD student, who tragically died a few months ago as a young man, leaving a young wife, a baby. Excuse me. Motion. Okay. Ritter's condition is that if you take an element in the unit interval, call it E, so this would be an effect. And if it turns out that if twice that element is bigger than or equal to 1, then the element is equal to 1. That's Ritter's condition. So this defines a Heilprin-Ritter ring. Example of a Heilprin-Ritter ring. The integers, take the integers, right? Partially ordered in the usual way, right? If you take an integer that lies between 0 and 1, well, there are only two of them, right? And if twice it is bigger than 1, it must be 1. So the integers form a Heilprin ring. Now, every Heilprin-Ritter ring is an effect-ordered ring. That's not hard to prove. And what happens is, just as with the case of the integers, you get, when you look at the Hermitian elements, they're all the elements in the ring. This comes from the commutativity, really. And again, and on this other end, we get an equality between the projections and the effects. So those two containments collapse on the two ends, and you get a Boolean algebra on that end, and of course you get an HR ring here, and this thing, which is the HR ring, simply regarded as a partially ordered abelian group. And notice that these two conditions here don't really involve multiplication in the ring at all, only addition. I'll call that a Heilprin-Ritter group. All right, I got 4 minutes. What's interesting about this? You go back and you read Boole's monumental works, the Algebra of Logic, and that was, 1847 or so, and the Laws of Thought. Go back and you read those things, and you'll find that of course, Boole never defined what we now call a Boolean algebra. He talked about terms, which he was thinking of as classes or perhaps as propositions. And he talked about combining these terms using operations that he wanted very much to be analogs of the operations of addition and multiplication in ordinary algebra. And in particular, he did not want things like x plus x equals x to obtain, unless x was equal to 0. Does that remind you of something? Effect algebra? If in an effect algebra, x circle plus x equals 0, then x equals 0. That's what Boole wanted. And so Boole insisted that if he was interpreting his classes as sets, that the classes must be disjoint. He said in the Laws of Thought, in strictness, the words and or interposed between the terms descriptive of two or more classes of objects imply that these classes are quite distinct. so that a member of one is, no member of one is found in another. In this, get this now, in this and all other respects, the words and or are analogous with the sign plus in algebra, and their laws are identical. Now, why is Halpern's name on this ring? Well, Halpern went back and looked at Boole's work, and he said, hey, let's see if we can figure out what Boole really meant. And he wrote a book on logic, but later on he wrote a neat little paper published in Math Magazine called Boole's Algebra is Not Boolean Algebra. And he argues that Boole's algebra is precisely this ring R. He says, while he, Boole, never made his algebra fully explicit, we inferred that what he did use was, if clarified, a commutative ring with unit without nilpotents and having idempotents, projections now, that stand for classes. This is Heilprin's ring. And the abstract characterization of Heilprin's ring is due to Ritter. And so this is the Boolean part of my picture. And my time is up. So if you want to read the rest of it, I guess you have to wait till you can get a hold of some paper or other that I've written. But I thought maybe it might be more important that you see sort of the big picture than that you see the minutiae of what a compression-based group really is. It's just a generalization of the group of self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space enhanced by compression operators. And compression operators are Neimark compressions. You know, you take an operator and you map A and you map it into PAP, where P is a projection. That's a Neimark compression. And the Neimark dilation, there are a number of dilation theorems that go in the other way. When you compress a projection, you get an effect operator, right? When you dilate, you go backwards and you try to get projections that project down to the compression operator. And there are lots of important theorems, like the Neimark-Nash theorem, that says that if you take a covariant POV measure, POV measure interacting properly with a group of symmetries, then you can lift it up by dilation to a projection valued measure, covariant projection valued measure. And so all of the stuff that people used to do in the old days with sharp measurements, with sharp observables, can in principle be done with fuzzy observables by using the Nash-Neimark compression dilation theorem. And so all I did was I built these projections into the group, and things work out pretty well. At least I like the way they work. And if you want to see how they work, have a look at the paper sometime. And thank you very much for your attention. And I hope nobody has jumped out the window. There is. Absolutely. The polar decomposition, I'm not so sure about. Spectral decay, yeah, you need a little extra structure for that. But of course, you need some extra structure for the spectral decomposition. I think I left a couple papers out on the table there, but they're old papers. I had too many hypotheses. But yeah, the spectral decomposition stuff works. And as far as normal operators work, if you take a normal operator in the bounded operators and you can decompose it under the Cartesian decomposition into two self-adjoint operators, a self-adjoint operator plus I times another self-adjoint operator, if it's normal, these two operators commute. They're sitting down in the, I mean, if they have spectral decompositions, the projections and the spectral decompositions commute with one another. You can put it all together. So that you can do. There's no problem with that. Polar decomposition, well, that's just lurking in the background then. Essentially, if you have something like spectral decomposition, you're very close to having polar decomposition, because you can get spectral decomposition from polar decomposition the way Nagy did years and years ago in the functional analysis book. I can tell you how that goes if you like privately. Yeah. I wish I knew. One of the interesting examples that I didn't get to has to do with MV algebras. MV algebras are the Lindenbaum-Tarski algebras for Lukasiewicz multivalued logics. And there's a beautiful theorem of Mundici to the effect that every MV algebra can be written as the unit interval in a partially ordered abelian group with a strong order unit. And the partially ordered group is, in fact, lattice ordered. And in fact, these lattice ordered groups with strong ordered unit are the same thing as MV algebras. Now, in certain cases, the Mundici group is actually the Hermitian group of a ring. I don't know when that happens. I suspect, however, that it has something to do with the question of whether the MV algebra is also a Heiting algebra. Because if it is, then you have a spectral theorem. That's all you need to get the machinery you need to get the spectral theorem to go. And I think from the spectral theorem, you can figure out how to multiply things together. And I haven't worked on that, but that may be a partial answer to your question. Howard? Sorry. I think so. Of course, Jordan algebras are JPW algebras are a good example of these structures. Now, can you go in the other direction and get the Jordan product? When can you pull the Jordan product out of this Hermitian group? I don't know the answer to that. But again, if you have enough spectral theory going for you, I think you can do it. All you have to do is get squares, and then the rest of it is going to come for free. So I think there are lots of theorems lurking here. And there's lots of work that needs to be done. And I think it's interesting and fascinating work. And I wish I had some help.